Recording audio. And so again, welcome folks to the Q&A for the Ottawa PC User Group. Anybody who's joining us for the first time, welcome. Please feel free to participate in any way that you can add to the discussion, either questions, answers, or shares of information you'd like to share with other people. With that, I'd like to kick it over to Alan to take us through tonight's deck. And Alan, you have to unmute yourself.
There we go. That maybe works a bit better.
Yes.
Okay, so welcome everyone. And we do have a bunch of slides tonight, so we'll start right in. The first thing, just following up on last week, remember somebody suggested that they would like to know about computer security, and I think it was Tom, actually. And suggested that it would be good to have multiple people give their versions of what software they use, if there's any real exceptional programs, best practices for all kinds of different security and systems. So if you have any information that you'd like to share, just send us a line to our suggestion box, and when we get round to this topic, we'll certainly include your input. Okay, so the next thing, as Bob just mentioned, is a follow-up from his Computers at War presentation from last week. So, Bob, over to you.
Last week during my presentation, after I talked about Alan Turing, who's one of the very pivotal figures in the history of computing, I pointed out that the film based on his life, The Imitation Game, was, as much as it's an entertaining film, it had quite a few historical inaccuracies, and it was sort of rated as being only 40-45% historically accurate. And somebody asked a question, well, what are some of the inaccuracies? And I didn't have the information right at hand. But if you look at your screen there, I've listed two websites there. One is a at-length article on how accurate is The Imitation Game, and it points out quite a few inaccuracies. And the other one is the Wikipedia article on the movie, and it also has an extensive selection on the inaccuracies. But just to point out a few, the movie gives the impression that Alan Turing was the main figure behind the Colossus computer. And in actual fact, he had relatively little to do with the development of the Colossus. It was mostly Tommy Flowers and Tut. I forget Tut's first name there. It gives the impression Turing is one of four people known as the Wicked Uncles, that wrote to Churchill about issues and problems at Bletchley Park. And the movie gives the impression that it was Turing alone who did this, and that Churchill put him in charge of breaking the Enigma codes. And Alan Turing was never in charge of breaking the Enigma codes. There's the intimation that the Russian spy at Bletchley, Cairncross, was blackmailing Turing because of his homosexuality. In fact, Cairncross and Turing probably never actually met. They were in completely different parts of Bletchley. And in any case, Alan Turing couldn't be blackmailed because of his homosexuality, because he's quite open about it. Most everybody he knew, he worked with at Bletchley, knew he was gay. So it gives the impression in the movie as well that Alan Turing had a very crusty personality. He was hard to work with and everything. People that worked with him say he was very approachable, a bit of a joker. And even though he liked to work alone a lot of the time, he wasn't the kind of character that he's portrayed in the movie. And as well, the movie suggests that he has traits of Asperger's syndrome, which is a form of autism, And in fact, he never displayed those types of traits. And lastly, Denniston was the guy initially in charge of Bletchley, and because of the letter the four the Wicked Uncles wrote, the management was turned over to somebody else, but Denniston is portrayed in the movie as being a very inflexible, rigid character who tried to stop the development of the breaking of the Enigma codes, and that's not true at all. In fact, he was very well liked, and as I pointed out in my presentation, Denniston's main problem was he just wasn't a manager. He was at Bletchley. He was one of the foremost code breakers, and as such was well liked and respected by most of the people he worked with. So there's a lot of inaccuracies there in the movie, but like I said, it's an entertaining movie. Enjoy it for what it is. Just be aware that it's not a real true depiction of history.
Okay, thanks very much, Bob. Okay, so our next item is basically in response to somebody who wanted to know about file management. Last week I talked a bit about how to organize files and folders, and tonight I want to just touch on some issues relating to backup and indexing. So if you remember, I said that I use a dedicated data partition and organize my own set of folders within that partition. And one of the reasons I do that is because it makes backup very easy. I use this program called Free File Sync, which is essentially a file and folder synchronization program. And it means that I can synchronize the whole of my data partition, which on my laptop, or on my desktop rather, shows up as drive E, because drive C is the operating system and drive D is the DVD burner. So the next available slot for my data partition when I made the partition on the hard drive, and it went from drive C to drive C and drive E. So I basically set Free File Sync to synchronize drive E, which is my data partition, to a flash drive, which I use just for this purpose. And basically Free File Sync, it basically makes a mirror image, if you like, of the data partition to the flash drive. So if there's any new files on the data drive, or if I've updated any of the files, or if I've deleted any files, then those are reflected when I run Free File Sync on the flash drive. So I end up with a backup copy, if you like, of that moment in time when I make the backup. And this is basically what the program looks like. You've got the data drive is drive E on the left, and my flash drive is showing up as drive H on the right. And if we zoom in a bit, you can see that I've got a whole bunch of files on the left-hand side, which are due to be processed. And one of them you'll see is called filemanagement.pptx. So that's this particular set of slides, the file management slides. I had them in a separate file. I've edited it, and now it wants to copy it across to my backup drive. And there's another set of files down here, which if you notice on the right-hand side, they're all showing as going to the garbage bin. So these are files which they belong to my smartphone. They're actually backup images of my smartphone at various times. and I've archived them to a big external drive, so I don't need them on my working data partition anymore. So I'm ready to delete them now. So I've deleted them from the data drive, and it wants to delete them on the backup drive. So that makes backup really easy. I just I make a very quick backup every time I play with a computer. It updates the backup drive on the flash drive. What about disk indexing? We talked a bit about that, and I'd said that I don't use the Windows disk index because I find it's not very good, basically. So Chris had talked about how to turn it off, and you can see that I have done that on this machine. Windows indexing is not running, so it's disabled. So what do I use instead? Well, Chris had suggested a long time ago, and Tom mentioned this in his presentation about finding disk space, the program called Everything. And this is a search engine that basically lists all the files and folders on your system, and it's pretty instant. It's amazingly quick. And so as soon as you run it, it goes and looks at your system and loads all the different files. So now you want to actually search for something. So in the search bar there, we're going to enter file M for file management, because that's the file we were working on just recently. And you can see we get a whole raft of file M type things. And clearly my file management ones are about a third of the way down there. But you can be more sophisticated than that. You can actually say, I want to do file M star.pptx, because I know that it's file management and I know it's a pptx file. So I can use wildcards to narrow down my search, and clearly by picking the right wildcard, you can get exactly to the file that you want. Now just note here that it's finding two files. One is the file management on drive E, which if you remember is my dedicated data drive, but it's also finding the same file on drive J, and drive J is a new one to us now. That's actually on my laptop, and it's an SD card which is plugged in permanently, and I use some real-time backup software to make a real-time copy of my data drive. We'll talk about that in a second. So you can use wildcards to narrow down your search in Everything. And now Chris tells me that, or reminds me that, Everything looks for file names, but it doesn't necessarily search for content. It doesn't index files for content. But you can use a content switch, if you like, or a parameter. So his example is, if I search for star.docx, like all Microsoft Word document files, and look for the word Iceland as content, then it will go through all the docx files it finds. It will check the content, and if the word Iceland shows up, it will display those files. And Chris says that will be relatively slow, depending how many files you have to search. And I actually think it's really quick. I tried doing this thing, and if I use some wildcards, and you remember when I write review type articles, I usually have this thing at the bottom of the page that says bottom line, and I give the reference to the program and whether it's freeware and that kind of thing. So I decided to search all my docx files for the content for the word bottom, thinking I'd find bottom line. And sure enough, I can see some files in there that are newsletter articles, but there's a whole bunch of other Word documents that clearly have the word bottom. I mean, for whatever reason, it's probably not bottom line, but it's the bottom of something in these various documents. So then the second thing I try is, well, let's be much more specific, and let's do a specific search string by using inverted quotes and look for actually bottom line. And when you do that, it narrows it down to three articles, which are actually articles which are in the pipe to be published in the newsletter one of these days, I think. Now, Chris pointed out that everything has a whole raft of different options that you can use. So, for example, you can use Boolean terms, so you can search for this and that, or this or that. You can use case if you want to match uppercase rather than have it case independent. It has some date functionality, so for example, you could say DM this year, and that will look for files that were modified during the current calendar year. It has some interesting ones. If you're into digital photography, you can use the height colon 640, and it will look for images that have a height of 640 pixels. If you're looking for a whole bunch of files, you can submit it as a list of file names using the file list feature. And if you're into music and you use tags, then you can you can look for things like artist colon and then, I don't know, Johnny Cash or something. And if you have an ID3 or a flat tag with the artist filled in, it will actually search and find those music files for you. So it's quite a powerful utility. And as I say, it's really quick. I think it's a fabulous little utility. So moving on to this real-time backup system, I use a program called Quick Shadow Backup, and I've reviewed that in the newsletter a number of years ago. And this basically is a utility, again, to create a mirror of a set of folders on one particular drive and copy them to a second drive. But it does it basically in real time. So it's sitting there in the background as a terminate and stay resident type program. It looks at the folders that you tell it to monitor, and when something changes, it instantly reflects that change on the second drive. So again, if there are new files or updated files on the main drive, then they get copied to the target. If you delete files from the source drive, then they get deleted from the target. And as I say, that happens in essentially real time. So this is the program. It comes from a company in Australia, but there's a free version which worked really well, and there's a paid for version that has some extra features which I don't actually need, so I use the free version. It's a very exciting program, and when you run it, this is basically what you see. Like nothing's usually happening. It's just sitting there idling and monitoring the folders that you tell it to. But if you go into the setup, you'll see there's a whole raft of things that you can do. And you can tell it which set of files and folders you want to monitor. And I've just told it to use the whole of drive E, which is if you remember, that's my data drive. So it's going to take all of the files and folders on my dedicated data drive, and it's going to send them to drive J, which can be an SD card, or it could be a second hard drive in my desktop, for example, which sits there all the time and is available for this process. And then you can include files, you can exclude files, you can set schedules, you can do all kinds of wonderful things. And I basically just do very simple things. And if you're lucky and you catch it actually doing something, you see here I've downloaded a new version of GIMP, which is the latest version, 2.10.22. And I downloaded it to my hard drive, and Quick Shadow's seen that, and now it's copying it to the backup drive automatically. So this all happens without me doing anything. So I end up with a current backup of my data file. Now, there are other ways to do this kind of shadow backup type process, and one of them Chris had talked about a while ago, and he made me put this in, file history, part of Windows. But just note, this is a Microsoft product, and everybody knows how much I like Microsoft products. So I'll leave it to Chris to expound the virtues of file history.
Well, let me just speak to that very shortly, because it does almost real-time backup. It doesn't do it as real-time. You can back it up where it looks for changes every 10 minutes. So it's pretty close to real-time. The other thing that I think has a real charm to it is that it can keep multiple versions of files as you're working on them, and it can keep them basically forever until you run out of space on the drive you're using to back things up to. So if you want the version of the file that you were working on, you know, at 2 p.m. yesterday afternoon, you can go back and get that version of it, or, you know, last Friday's version. So it's really nice for that, about being able to have a version history. And it's free. It's in the box on every Windows 10 computer. So.
And that version history, Chris, is a useful activity. That's something that I don't think Quick Shadow Backup does. It may be in the pro version, like the paid-for version.
Yeah, I think the paid version does have version history that it can deal with.
It doesn't have it in the free version. Yeah. But do I remember that there's a feature of file history that you have to be using Defender?
No, file history. No, that works completely independent of it. It's another feature, that security feature that you need to be using Defender.
Okay. So this is in no way comparable to Apple's Time Machine, though.
It has similar sort of functionality, but it's not as elegant as Time Machine. Time Machine does have its drawbacks as well. I'm just going from a feature list that I read about, and there are some things that it's a little bit awkward for, but overall it's very, very sweet for anybody who wants a backup solution on Apple. As far as I know, everybody who does backup on Apple, they just use Time Machine, period.
Yeah, just remember, Time Machine is the dark side of it.
Yes.
Right, so Chris made me put in file history, but here's a program that we agree on is a really good program. If you're trying to find files, and especially if you're trying to find files to make some space and get rid of things, Tom again had mentioned this one, the TreeSize 3. It basically, you run the program, scan a particular drive, and it gives you a list of files and folders, basically in the order of largest folder first. So for example, you can see that on this solid-state drive, I've got 102 gigabytes assigned to the Windows C drive. 26 gigabytes is being used by Windows. Probably can't do much about that. But I've got 18 gigabytes, which is almost 20% of the drive, is using this folder called Moto. And Moto is it's obvious that that's my smartphone. And if I look at Moto, 16 gig of that 18 gig is being used by TWRP, which is my backup program. So most of that space is being taken up by timed backups, like full image backups of my smartphone, which are probably not critical to keep. I could archive those, or I could actually throw them away, the older ones. And so I could very quickly zoom in and find out what's taking the most space, exactly which files and folders are doing that, and decide how to eliminate them or move them somewhere where they're not taking up space on my actual hard drive. So those are the kind of things that I do in terms of file management, file backup, and file indexing. So we'll move along. Well, this is a question from Glenn. It's multi-part, so I'll go through the various parts and people can think about how they're going to help Glenn with this. I've got a couple of ideas at the end. Basically, he's thinking about creating electronic Christmas cards and sending it as an email attachment. So can you suggest free software for creating e-cards? And he suggests a starting point would be LibreOffice Impress, which, if you're not familiar, that's essentially the equivalent of Microsoft PowerPoint. So it's a presentation manager which produces slides. What about the best document format to use that can be read by multiple computers and multiple operating systems? And he suggests maybe that should be a PDF. He'd like the card to be two pages. Whoever receives the card will see the first page. He'd like to have he thinks it would be nice to have a button on the bottom of the page that when you click, it goes to the second page. But can you do this without using scripting or macros? Because that might choke on a virus, antivirus software, or somehow block the email. I think he's going to take a photograph of a winter scene and incorporate that into the card. Otherwise, he's going to use what Chris suggested, clip art from favpng.com. But FavPNG says that their products are only available for personal use. So he's asking, should I annotate it and say, for personal use only, copyright favpng.com, in order to warn recipients that they can't use it for anything other than personal use. And finally, and this is applicable to everybody tonight, can you provide any other helpful suggestions or tips for creating an attractive e-card, and are there any pitfalls to be avoided when doing so? So while you're all thinking about that, my suggestions are that certainly Impress or Writer, which is the LibreOffice word processor, the equivalent to Microsoft Word, you could use either of those to create a two-page e-card. Writer might be better if you want to have a lot of text, i.e. one of them is going to be a one-page letter, and this, the first page is going to be some kind of picture. Writer might be a better choice for lots of text. Certainly PDF is probably the way to go. I mean, it seems to me it's the most popular multi-platform document format. And everybody I know has a PDF reader. So if you send them a PDF file, obviously they'll be able to read it. But the thing is about that, if you send a PDF, then all readers have a kind of a page turning feature. You can go forwards and backwards using arrows or icons or something. So now you don't need a control button on the front page because you just click and you go to page two. And in any case, implementing a control button in LibreOffice Impress might be difficult because Impress has no macro recording capability. Writer and Calc, they do have macro recording. So I guess you could create a macro and then install that macro in Impress. But if you're going to use PDF, it's kind of a moot point anyway. You don't need a button. When you look at the favpng.com website, there is no copyright on any of their images. It states that the images can be used for personal use, but commercial use is not allowed. But if that's what you say and you don't have an actual copyright notice, I don't see how you can enforce that. But, you know, maybe just as a courtesy, you could put image obtained from favpng.com and for personal use only. Now, my suggestion for making things really simple, well, this is essentially for a one-page e-card. In Thunderbird, which is the email client that I use, it's basically an HTML-based message. So you can include things like tables, images. So I can, if you look at the slide here, I basically told it, I want to create a table, and I want that table to be one row by two columns. And then when I do that, I can paste in things. So on the left-hand part of the table, I've created a whole bunch of text. And because it's HTML, I can use different fonts, I can use italics, I can use colors. So I can set up my message that I want to send people to say Merry Christmas or season's greetings or whatever I want. And I can also include an image. So I pasted an image here. It's actually a picture I've taken. You can see I photoshopped it slightly just to make it pertain to Christmas. And this is a bird from southern Texas, so hence the Merry Christmas, y'all. And the beauty of this is, of course, once I've created my card for Chris and sent it to him, wish Merry Christmas, Chris, by the way, once I send him his Christmas card, I can forward the same card to dozens of people, friends and relatives and all kinds of things. So I find it a very convenient way to do all kinds of different cards, Christmas cards, birthday cards, all kinds of wonderful things. Now, clearly, there are all kinds of other ways you can do it. Somebody's telling me how to do it in the chat. Chris is fast asleep, so he's muted, so he can't say anything.
Yeah, so we do have some comments in the chat. We have a question. Has anybody used Jacqueline Lawson e-cards? I get some from my aunt. I've never used it other than to read the ones that she sends to me. They certainly are very attractive, animated. They're quite elaborate cards. I don't know anything about the cost or anything like that. I presume it's a costed service, but I'm not 100% sure. Eldon mentioned about that. If you have any comments on known costs or anything like that, if you could chip in, that'd be great. Somebody else, Janika, got cards from there as well. Hasn't tried using it. B says used it for several years, find it quite useful, and their animations have improved over the years. B, is it a free service or is there a cost to using that? If you could chime in on that, that would be great.
I know Bill uses it.
No, it's not free. And I will look up before the end of the meeting what the cost is.
Actually, I got it from somebody and said it was about $15.
I don't find it very expensive for what you get. I mean, after you've used it for a long time, you get so that there's not so many options to send people. But at first, anyway, you can usually find a card that's appropriate for nearly everyone. It is a cop-out, of course, on some levels because you're not making it yourself. But they have improved. Their animations were pretty crude at the beginning, but now they're quite nice. And some people in my circle really enjoy the advent calendars where you have those do cost $5 a piece. You can send them an advent calendar and you electronically open the windows and there's something behind the window. Sometimes it's a game. Sometimes it's not chocolate. They can't send you chocolate. But I find them very useful. And certainly worth the price.
Yeah, Jocelyn commented, he said Canadian, $20 a year, $30 for 2 years.
Yeah, that sounds right. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay, that's it for the comments so far. I'll keep my eye open for more.
Okay. All right, so we can move along. This is a question from Lawrence. He has a colleague who's retired is going through all slides and pictures that he's going to scan to create digital pictures. And he's looking for software that will allow simple editing, i.e. cropping, and organizing the pictures that he saves. And do we have any recommendations? My recommendation is a program I've used for a number of years. I love these digital image management type programs. And this one's a free one. It's called Fastone Image Viewer. In the screenshot here, you can see there's various ways you can configure the layout. This is the way I like to do it. In the top left-hand box there, you get a tree directory of your drive, so you can select a given folder. And then in that folder on the right-hand side, it pops up a bunch of thumbnails of the various images that are in the folder. If you click once on one of the images, then it pops up in the preview window on the left, bottom left. And you can resize all of these different windows so it displays the way that you want to display it. If you double click on an image, then it, by default or by feature, by option, you can have it take up the full window. And then it gives you buttons to go forward and backwards of the slides in that window. Or you can, by option, you can set it to go full screen. So there's a whole bunch of different ways you can view various images. It's really handy. But it also, you see, it has a bunch of icons along the top of the window. So it has editing tools. It certainly has a cropping tool, which is very easy to use. And there are icons that let you change the brightness and the contrast, adjust the color balance on the slide, that kind of thing. It also has options for renaming slides and resizing slides in batch mode. So you can basically take all of the slides in all of the pictures in a folder and resize them to make them smaller, to send them by email or to post them on the web or whatever you want to do. So it's a very flexible but very powerful, and it's free, and it works really, really well.
Now, Alan, before you go on, can you go back a slide?
Yeah.
I just wonder, you say it's a free digital image manager. Does it do anything like allow you to give ratings to photos or keywords and things like that?
I don't know. I never do that kind of stuff, so I couldn't tell you. I don't know whether it has a tagging function or not. It may do.
Yeah, there was a comment as well in the chat from Yannicka about UrfanView. So UrfanView is another one that is similar to Fastone Image Viewer, available at UrfanView.org. If somebody wants something, same sort of flavor, but just a little bit different.
Yeah, there's a raft of these kind of things, but this is my favorite at the moment.
Yeah.
Okay, so you had some thoughts too, Chris.
Yeah, I think if the person's editing needs are really, really modest, like they only mention wanting to be able to crop, basically any image editor will work, including things like Fastone and UrfanView and any true image editor. Will actually give you that capability. I really caution people not to go with the really basics because it doesn't give you room to grow. And so unless you're really adamant that you don't want anything in your face about these additional features, you're probably better off to really go to a photo editor, a true photo editor. And that way, even if you don't use tools right away, you may find a little bit later on, oh, there's this slide, this photo looks a little bit dark. And, oh, I can go with this slider to do that. Or maybe you just need to give a boost to shadows, so you'll find a slider that allows you to just boost the shadows. Or, later on you might find that, oh, I can do a little bit of cloning on the image to remove imperfections. Or I can mask part of the photograph and apply an effect just to that. So it allows you to grow with the program as your needs with your photography grow. And so I really encourage people to actually look to something a little bit more advanced. Linda, who's on the call tonight, she's a big fan of Photoscape X. She teaches how to use Photoscape X, and she's actually going to give a little bit of a demo of some of the really basics of photo editing probably next week at Q&A. So Photoscape X is available free of charge. The biggest thing that's missing from the free version is it doesn't have a clone tool. And anybody who gets into photo editing, very quickly you find that the lack of a clone tool is a real impediment. The paid version has a clone tool. However, they still have available their non-X version of it, so Photoscape 3.7, and it actually does have a clone brush in it. And so using a combination of Photoscape 3.7 in order to do the clone brush, Photoscape X for everything else, it's pretty hard to beat for a free editor. That pair of programs will give you an awful lot of capabilities to take your photographs to sort of the next level.
Chris, can I just interrupt for a second?
Yeah.
If that's okay. So what I promise to do next week is not a demo of Photoscape X, because it is a lot more comprehensive and it would take me longer. But I thought, you know, if people are really just wanting to get their feet wet and they have a Windows 10 environment, then the Windows Photo program that's built into your Windows 10 is a really good way to just get your feet wet and get familiar with the basic concepts. It's not scary because there aren't a million buttons around. And I hear what Chris is saying, but honestly, that's the way I started. I liked it. It was so plain and simple, and it was really easy for me to take what I learned there and apply it to any other software program I've seen, because then you start seeing the similarities. So there's nothing wrong with starting for something basic, and that's what I'll demo next week, because it's small enough I can do it in 10 or 15 minutes.
Okay, thanks, Emma. So just carrying on with this, there was the question about being able to organize photographs. And I always caution people to be really careful about picking a program that allows you to do a lot of the things like ratings and keywords and things like that, that may tie you into that particular program going forward. And that can be an impediment. And if you go to the trouble of categorizing, you know, 5,000 photographs on your computer, you know, it's a daunting task to decide, well, this program is a little bit limited, I'd rather go with something else. And you may have, you know, throw out all of that work that you did of categorizing and tagging all of those photographs. For me, I find that if I just organize my photos using the file system, it works really well. I have folders by year, and then within each year, I have subfolders by date and location. So I'll have, you know, 2020-11-11-arboretum or something like that. And I find that I can find all of my photos quite easily using that technique. I have over 160,000 photos on my computer, and for me, that suffices. But it does not give me the ability to do cross-referencing. So I can't, you know, go in, tag all my photographs and say, these are my flower photos. And then if I need a flower photo, you know, pull up all of those in one view and then decide which one I want to pick from, or photos of a particular person, or photos with metadata out of the photos themselves, the EXIF information, such as being able to pick out all of the photos that were using a particular focal length, f-stop, aperture or shutter speed or things like that, and rating of photographs to be able to say, oh, I think this is a one-star photograph or this is a five-star photograph. So it doesn't give me that ability. If there are other people out there who know of a program that is designed specifically for you know, organizing your photographs where you can put in that extra data, tagging them with keywords, looking up or searching by metadata in the photograph, things like that. I would love to hear about it. I'm not sure that I would actually use it at all, but other people on the call here may find it to be something they'd like to try out. So if anybody else has some input into this, please speak up.
Okay, Corrine had a question about this topic. How are the slides digitized? Is a special scanner used? there are certainly commercial companies that will scan slides for you. If you want to do it yourself, you have to have a scanner with enough resolution. I don't know much about that. Has anybody here used a scanner to slide to digitize 35 mil slides?
I haven't used it myself, but I know that the Ottawa Public Library, a couple of their branches have high resolution slide scanners that are available once they are open for business. Beaverbrook, I know, is one of them. And I believe Barrhaven, the branch out there, Ruthie Dickinson, I think that they have one as well. I think there's three branches now that actually do have slide scanners available that you can book time on their system. I don't know if they're in operation again at this point in time, but you could contact the Ottawa Public Library and check with them.
Yeah, Bob Walker here. A few years ago, I got a scanner from a company called Wolverine, and basically it has a carrier that you slide through that'll either take 35 millimeter negatives or 35 millimeter slides, regular slides and all that, and you can save everything to an SD card that you plug into the device, and so if you don't want to schlep over to a library branch, you can sit there watching some mindless TV one night, and just as you're doing it, you'll start popping your slides or your negatives through it. If it's a negative, it'll do the reverse thing and turn it into a positive on the SD card. So you don't even have to have this plugged into your computer. Now, at the time I got it from Amazon.com because it wasn't available on Amazon Canada. And at the time on Amazon.com, they wouldn't ship it to Canada because, for licensing reasons. So I got it shipped to my USA address in Ogdensburg there and picked it up there. I'm sure by now there are several other companies have comparable scanners. At the time, it cost about $100, but again, like everything electronic, the prices go down. So
they go up too. I'm just looking at Amazon Canada, and there is a Wolverine Titan 8-in-1 high resolution film to digital converter with 4.3-inch screen and HDMI output for the low price of $317.11.
Yeah, as I mentioned in my presentation I gave a while back on online shopping, you'll find that the price difference sometimes between Amazon Canada and Amazon USA is staggering. I've seen things on Amazon USA for $7.50 that are $75 in Canada,
yeah,
on Amazon Canada. So you got to shop around for these things a little bit. And the idea that Amazon always has the best price can change quite a bit. I found, for example, you know, trying to buy a spare power supply for a laptop so I could have one at work or one at home. From the Lenovo Canada website, it was $75. Lenovo USA website, it was $40. Amazon Canada website, it was $25. Amazon USA website, it was $10.
Yeah.
So you have to sort of shop around for these things.
And Peggy was asking whether there's a scanner that will convert negatives to positives, essentially. And I guess you just said, Bob, that Wolverine unit you had did that.
Yeah, it takes the negatives and flips them into positives if you're just scanning in negatives. So, and I'm sure most of the other negative slash slide scanners do the same thing.
Yeah. And Eldon says that he thinks that the Wolverine is the equipment that the library uses. So that would be worth checking out.
And B mentioned that she had a similar one, different brand, got a Best Buy several years ago. It was definitely less than $100. Sometimes you get what you pay for. There was a slide scanner that I had that was fairly inexpensive, but it was so bad that I found it to be totally useless. So, it your mileage may vary, I guess.
Yeah, another thing is I previously had a big flatbed scanner, and it came with a negative slash slide carrier you could use on the flatbed scanner, and but I found that was very, very limited and never gave me a result that was worth taking the time.
Nick has a comment. The only scanner I currently have available, aside from the Canon M3500 series printer, an Epson Perfection 1260 with 48-bit 1200 by 2400 DPI. So just using a regular scanner for something like that. And I think that's all of the comments in the chat about that.
Yeah, the problem with using a flatbed scanner with an adapter to do the negatives and slides is you may not get the resolution you need, because the scanner that goes on the flatbed only uses the resolution of the flatbed scanner itself. So you're not getting the kind of resolution you may want for your slides or for your negatives. So it's probably better to use a dedicated scanner.
Right.
And there was another issue here mentioned by B. I found the most difficult part was getting the dust off.
Getting
the dust off the slides when you scan them, I guess you get huge particles of dust.
Either that or you got a lot of cleanup work to do in post-processing.
That's true. Yeah. Okay. So the next issue is a share from me. You recall earlier I mentioned that I downloaded the latest version of GIMP, which is version 2.10.22, and we've also been talking about the use of Free File Sync, and I loaded a whole bunch of upgrades to various software packages. There was a Windows feature update came in around the same time, so lots of stuff got updated. And then one morning I did some work on the PowerPoint file, and then I went to run my Free File Sync, and you can see that down the bottom of the screen here, it's found my Q&A.ppdx file, and it's going to copy it across to the backup. But it's also found this folder called A and Temp and MySys and tons of stuff in this folder called A, and I've never seen this folder called A before. So if you look at the folder called A, it's got a whole bunch of subfolders, and if you drill down through those subfolders, eventually you get to the bottom and you find this file called cachedir.tag, and that file is actually a text file, and it tells me that this is a cache directory tag, which is created by a program called FontConfig. And if I want to know more about it, then I should go to this brinosaurus.com website. So I'm a sucker for that, so I'll go and look at his website. And it turns out this cache directory stuff is the brainchild of this guy. And the idea is that you create this cache directory.tag file, and then backup programs will look at that, and it will tell the backup program, well, this folder and this folder and this folder are all caches for various applications, so don't bother backing them up because it's a waste of time and space. And when you look at the list of things that are using it, one of them right here is one of the programs I use, which is VLC, which is a video viewer, and Mozilla web browser, which would be Firefox, I guess, which I actually don't use, openoffice.org, Well, I now use LibreOffice, so that may not be applicable. But the program that hit me was the GIMP, because I know that I uploaded the new version of the GIMP quite recently. And in fact, that morning, when I was working on this PowerPoint file, I played around with an image. And so clearly, I probably used GIMP and I used PowerPoint, and maybe it's GIMP that's doing the problem. And sure enough, when I reboot my computer, I open up GIMP, I close GIMP, I look at the file structure, and there this A folder has popped up. So clearly GIMP is providing this cache directory file, but it's loading it onto my data drive when it probably should be loading it into a hidden folder in, you know, C colon users or a hidden folder in my Linux system or somewhere, not on a drive that I can see. So I take, and it's never done that before. So this is a brand new instance of something happening in a new version of a program. So for me, that shouts bug. So I basically log on to the website for the GIMP. There is no bug reported for this yet. So I basically filled out the magic form, and I tell them that they've got this bug in version 2.10.22, but the previous version, which was 2.10.18 series 2, it didn't happen in that one. So it's clearly a feature which has been added when they've done the software update. So anybody else is using GIMP on Windows 10, but if you're using 2.10.22, I'd be interested to know if you're seeing an odd folder pop up anywhere that you've never seen before. If you have, it's a bug.
And it'll be interesting to see if the GIMP people address this in a future update.
Yeah, I'll have to see that. Okay, so now we're at the time for any other questions. And I know that there was one question early on from Micheline. And Micheline says, I can find it. I've purchased and downloaded ABBYY Fine Reader, Abby Fine Reader PDF 15, Abby Fine Reader PDF 15 for Windows, the standard version. And she wants to know if this is a 16-bit or 32-bit program, and whether it should go into program files or whether it should be program files 86. And what does the 15 refer to? Is it the version number? Well, probably is the version number. And I thought I saw somebody reply on this one, but if anybody has any information on Abby Fine Reader PDF, shout out. If you have any other questions, comments, shares,
this is Jocelyn. Apparently, that program is an OCR. One thing I like to use is there is some free online OCR reader for simple use. That's a possibility.
Thanks, Jess.
If you run it, Task Manager will actually tell you whether it's a 32-bit program. If it doesn't say 32-bit beside the program name, then it's a 64-bit program.
We have to check Task Manager to see that, right?
Yep. Yeah, you have to run the program and then check in Task Manager, and it'll show you if it's a 32-bit program.
Presumably, you don't have to worry about where it's going to get installed. Generally, when you install a program, Windows decides where it's going to put it.
There's nothing magical about program files or program files x86 anyways. They're there to basically to allow you to have a 32-bit version of a program and a 64-bit version of a program, and they will then install to different directories. There's nothing magical about those particular directories. You can install a 64-bit program to program files x86 if you want.
Okay.
It'll work fine.
There's a question. LibreOffice is great. I use it with Mint. Are there any other Linux users that use GIMP in this group? There's at least one. Yours truly. I use Linux more than I use Windows. And I definitely use LibreOffice, and I definitely use GIMP. Okay, we're about that magic witching hour, so let me just mention two things. First thing, next week, I think Monday, is the OPL Tech Cafe, the library's Tech Cafe. Lawrence is doing his scam avoidance and trust presentation. That will be at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and if you want to join that, remember you have to register with the library, which you can do through our website there. And our next Q&A will be next week on the 25th. And as usual, if you have questions, answers to questions that are in the pipe, or anything that you want to share and discuss, we have our suggestion box email address there. You can send us a note. So thanks, everyone, and over to Chris.
Yeah, I guess we'll just wrap it up now. So, yes, I'd just like to echo the thanks for everybody showing up and the participation, especially we had a lot of participation in the chat window tonight, so that was great. So I will stop the recording, and we will get that posted onto the website along with the deck. So thanks again for everybody for attending, and we'll see you next week.
And the question, the last question, which link will the broadcast be repeated? It's on the website in the QA. You look at the menu, just go to the QA, and you'll find all the previous recordings there.